City Councilman Quentin Lucas won the recent mayoral election, and you would not be insane to argue that he ultimately won on his commitment to making affordable housing something we really talk about here in Kansas City. Here he is speaking with the Kansas City Star at City Hall last September.
For the first time, I think in a number of decades, Kansas City is focusing on affordable housing. So everything that comes through City Hall, be it an incentive conversation, be it a new program, is looking to how are we actually trying to make sure that there's housing availability for all families in Kansas City, no matter the income level.
Kansas City is not alone. Far from it. A new report shows that home ownership is bouncing back from the lows of the recession, but that housing supply isn't keeping up with demand. That's nationwide. If you look at the rental market, the fallout looks like rents rising at twice the rate of overall inflation throughout the country. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And the author of that report joins us now, Chris Herbert, Managing Director of Harvard's Joint Centers for Housing Studies. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. How would you describe the main takeaways of this report?
Well, Gina, I think there are really two, and you touched on those in your introduction. The first is really remarkably how little housing we've been producing relative to how much household growth has been taking off. In the years after the recession, we weren't building very much housing, in part because we built so much during the boom years, and in part because we weren't adding that many households. The slow economy was leading to slower formation of households, particularly among young people. But over the last 6 to 8 years, we've seen household growth come back to where it should be, and yet we haven't seen the supply of housing up to the level it should be. It's trailing by about 250 to 300,000 units a year from what we think it ought to be in order to accommodate that growth in households and also to accommodate the fact that every year we remove some housing from the stock due to obsolescence and deterioration.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Can I just jump in to clarify something?
Sure.
Because in a very simplified version of events, it would seem like the amount of housing we have, barring insane population growth, would be like fine over time, that you wouldn't need more houses, that people are born, people die. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, but the truth is we actually every year in this country right now, we're adding about 1.2 million households. Additionally, we're growing by 1.2 million households. So we have to add housing to accommodate those new households. And so, you know, it depends on what market you're in, how fast they're growing. But we do have population is continuing to grow, and it's, you know, both due to natural increase and due to immigration from other countries. And also there's a tendency for people to live in smaller households. So even the same population might be producing more demand for housing. So,
and that's what you mean by household growth, number of households, which does not always equate to number of people.
That's right. Household. So, you know, it's a little bit of a technical demographic term, but a household are just a group of people who live together in the same housing unit. So they either rent together or they live in a house they own together. So it's mom and dad and the kids, or it's, you know, roommates, or you know, grandma and her grandson. Whoever it is that lives together, that's a household.
And then, like, that whole aging in place movement could be also part of the whole household growth picture.
It is, you know, so one of the things that's happening now, as we look out over the next 10 or 20 years, if we look at the growth in households, by far the fastest growth is going to be among households over age 65. And in that case, it's not necessarily new households. It's just that some of us, myself included, are getting older and moving into that age group. And so it's not new household formation, but it's aging of existing households. And that group is growing rapidly. And as you mentioned, the tendency and the preference for most people is, as they age, is to want to stay in the house and the community where they've lived. And that's referred to as aging in place. And so for those households, we may not need to add new housing in the sense that they're already living somewhere. But what it does mean is because they're staying there and aging in place, they're not moving out of those homes and making space for the younger households who want to, say, move into home ownership or move into the communities where they live. And so we still need to accommodate those younger households somewhere. And, of course, some of those older households will want to move and will need to move as they age, and they might want to downsize. They might want to have a house that's, you know, single-floor living, more accessible, closer to their grandkids. So even though there's not necessarily new households among those older age groups, what they do has important implications for what kind of housing we need to add and where.
The other piece of this picture is the rising rent, and rent rising at twice the rate of overall inflation sounds crazy to me.
It is crazy. It makes life very hard for folks who are trying to find a place to live. And as the mayor you quoted saying that affordable housing is a significant issue, that's the nub of it, is that rents have been rising faster than inflation and, importantly, faster than incomes. And it goes back to that first, I said there are two themes. The first theme was we're not adding enough housing. Because we're not adding enough housing, that's helping to push up house prices and rents. And that's leading to these affordability challenges people are facing.
Yeah. Can you spell that out a little bit more? I mean, in Kansas City, we are experiencing this lack of affordable housing, especially for low-income residents, defined here roughly as people making less than $30,000 a year. But the rents are going high enough in a lot of neighborhoods where $30,000 a year would still be make it pretty tough to find a place to live. As I mentioned, this was a big issue in our mayoral race, and I'm curious about that, how that fits into what it is you're seeing in cities across the country, especially maybe cities of a similar size to Kansas City, of also Midwestern, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, so basically, if we look nationally, going back to, say, 2000, when we started this current century, we had about 39% of renters who are spending more than 30% of their income on housing, which is the common metric for saying whether housing's affordable or not. And that reflects the fact if you're spending more than that, then you probably don't have enough left over to spend on all of life's other necessities. Fast forward from 2000 until 2012, the share went from 38% to more than 50%. And so more than 50% of renters are now spending that more than 30% of their income in housing, and so in unaffordable conditions. So, and that trend
50% is crazy. That's huge.
It's half of all renters, and they're spending more than 30% of their income, and more than 25% of renters are spending more than half their income on renting, which really doesn't leave a lot left over for anything else. So, you know, your question was, how does Kansas City compare? Well, you know, the truth is, if you're living in high-cost markets, many of them on the coast, in California, the East Coast, but increasingly in some inland markets, too, like Denver and Nashville, the situation's worse in the sense that the share of households spending more than those amounts on their housing has gone up more, and it's actually started to affect, you mentioned $30,000 in income, people in those middle-income brackets more. And so that's true in Kansas City as well, although not to the same extent, but more and more, this question about people having a hard time getting housing that fits within their budget used to be primarily an issue of the lowest income households. Now, more and more, it's people making $30,000, $45,000, in the high-cost market, even up to $75,000 a year.
Can I just jump in here? Because the definition of middle class seems to me has been largely tied to this cultural idea of home ownership and of sort of the where you can live is a reflection of what, like, your class. But when you talk about that the middle income bracket cannot afford housing now, that seems like, are we changing the definition of middle class, or do we just no longer have a middle class?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, we still have a middle class. It's getting smaller. So there's two things that are happening. One is, you know, the broadening of the income distribution. So the fact that we have people at the top end doing better, people at the bottom end doing worse in many cases, or no better in others, means that the middle part is getting shrunk. So we have the middle class is smaller than it used to be. And if you're in that middle class, as you say, trying to find housing that you can afford, that's a key part of the American dream. And the other important piece of it, too, is access to college education and the notion of investing in your future and having a better life for you. And so if you look at the cost of college education and the cost of housing, both of those things have gone up much faster than incomes and have really squeezed the ability of people in the middle class to get access to those two key pillars of the American dream.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation if you have a question about what's going on right now with housing in America, in Kansas City, or if you have insights from the ground level here in town to share with our guest. He is a Harvard researcher. Chris, a housing deficit is part of what's going on here. Can you spell out a little more the relationship between that and the cost of rising rent?
Sure. You know, so the fact that we're not building enough housing means that there are a lot more people looking for housing units than we have. Now, of course, it's a little bit of a tautology there, which is that you know, basically, ultimately, people do find a place to live aside from those who are homeless, which is not an unimportant issue, but it's not a huge, you know, millions of households in the U.S. And so what happens is people then have to make choices about where am I going to live? And one thing that we're seeing over the last 10 years is kids living with their parents a lot longer. So that's one implication of the fact that housing is not affordable, is people don't live on their own. So either kids live with their parents or people double up. You have intergenerational households forming. And so one of the issues of the deficit is that people end up living together longer in more crowded situations, and then they're spending more of their income on housing as well. So just the lack of supply means that in the face of that demand, prices get bid up and some of that demand gets absorbed elsewhere.
You know, we recently spoke with a couple. They're trying to revive a neighborhood that was somewhat obliterated by white flight. First, the houses themselves were vacated, and then they were actually torn down. And they're doing something that a lot of people see as fairly radical. They've purchased a vacant lot, and they're building new houses that are going to be small and affordable for themselves and a handful of friends. It's very grassroots in that sense, but they did just learn about this housing deficit issue and suddenly came to see what they were doing as an intervention in something bigger than just this one neighborhood in this one city. What do you hear in that?
In terms of that kind of urban infill? Or,
yeah.
Well, you know, it does depend on what market you're in. And so certainly, you know, in a lot of cities that were devastated by, most recently, by the subprime lending crisis, which led to a lot of foreclosures and a lot of abandonment of homes, there are opportunities for urban infill. You know, I think, as you mentioned, white flight, and many of these communities were historically or recently minority communities, African-American communities in many cases. And so some of that revitalization that's happening, it's good to bring that investment back to the community, but it's how much of it is being done for the former residents and how much of it is, in essence, a gentrification process. And so we're certainly seeing some of that in markets, particularly in the Midwest, where those cities were most devastated by the subprime crisis. So it's a bit of a two-edged sword. It's an important investment, but we have to make sure that the investment's happening to help to the communities that were there and disadvantaged in the first place by the subprime crisis.
So you really do see the subprime crisis as, on some level, the origin of what's happening right now?
Yes and no. I mean, I think certainly the housing boom, and this is a whole topic for another show perhaps, had at its roots, one of its roots at least, was easy access to credit that helped drive up home prices to unrealistic levels. And then that bubble popped. It left a lot of devastation in its wake. That led to the issues you're seeing, you're describing now, in terms of what's happening in many inner city areas. In terms of the affordability problems we're having now, which goes back to this question of the lack of supply, is almost the, you know, what we're describing is an excess of supply in some cases in these neighborhoods. But there is a sense in which the damage done by that housing bust led to a lot of risk aversion on the part of lenders, on the part of land developers, on the part of some home builders, which has meant that we're not having as elastic a supply response, as economists would say. We're not seeing as big a supply response because of a lot of risk in this risk aversion in the system. And so the damage done by the housing bust in terms of what it did to the supply side, I think, is a part of why the supply is so constricted now, driving up prices and rents and adding to these affordability issues.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation with Chris Herbert of the Harvard Joint Centers for Housing Studies about the findings they just released this week. We're trying to put Kansas City's housing issues in context this morning. I want to talk to Joel in Kansas City. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Good. I just thought I would add a comment from a personal experience that my husband and I moved here in early 2016. And through a variety of reasons, we've had to move three times in 3 years. And we've rented each time. We've rented equivalent places. We haven't been like moving up in the market, so to speak. And basically, our rent has gone up by $300 a year each year, each time we've moved. And then like this year, we finally were able to re-sign a lease. But it didn't go up by $300, but they told us what the rate would be if we were being brand new coming in. You know, they gave us a better rate because we're an existing client. resident, and it would have been even much more than $300, probably closer to about $600.
Joel, can I ask you something? I don't mean to pry, but why were you moving after, why weren't you able to renew those previous leases?
It's fine. The first time we were renting from an individual landlord, and he decided he wanted the property back for himself. The second time was a bad experience at a property manager company, so we decided we couldn't stay there. And then finally, we're in a place where we've actually, first time, renewed our lease, and are very happy. And we live in downtown.
Chris, what do you hear in this?
Well, I think it's what we described at the beginning, the fact that rents are going up twice as fast as inflation is what Joel's been experiencing. And so, you know, each time he's been trying to go back out in the market, he's facing today's rents, and today's rents are higher than they were a year ago. And in places where demand is strong, you know, landlords are going to get the maximum rent they can. There will be, as he described, some tendency for landlords to give a break to tenants who are staying because they will avoid, you know, even a month or so of missing rent. So there'll be some opportunity for them to give a break. But still, I think he's living that experience of what does it mean for, an individual to face the market where rents are going up that fast.
Hey, Joel, I have a follow-up question for you, which is, as your rent has gone up $300 a year for the last 3 years, that's, by my math, $900 more in rent every month at this point. What has changed to make that possible? Is it higher income or is it sacrifices elsewhere?
A little bit of both. I mean, the income has not increased dramatically, certainly not that much. And then some of it is just, you know, like we're going down to one vehicle and, downsizing a few things. But if it continues to go up, that means we're probably going to have to look outside of the downtown area.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Joel, and good luck.
Thank you.
We have a question from Fred. Fred is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for taking my call. To your guest, quick question. Did your research include looking at housing cooperatives as a solution to the affordable housing crisis?
Fred, that's a good question. We did not get into the specifics of housing cooperatives. I think one of the issues that comes up a lot, which is somewhat related to cooperative, is the notion of community land trusts. The ways in which you can take market a little bit out of the private sector, housing out of the private sector, to protect against these rapid rises in essentially the value of land, and somewhere in between home ownership and renting. And so there's a growing interest in those forms of ownership where there's kind of nonprofit or public ownership of the land, and so the homeowner is protected against inflation, has to give up some of the upside. I don't know if you, by co-housing, you're thinking just more about group living situations as a way to share common space, which is another way. And all these are ways of trying to say, how do we deal with the fact that housing has become so expensive and how can we bring down the costs? And some ways are to, you know, have other ownership of land. Some ways are to think about smaller units, micro units, more co-living situations where you share common spaces. Those things are all having more discussion of them, I would say.
Yeah, like this could change how we live.
And I think that so far those are all fairly small in terms of how many situations like that are out there. But as I said, I mean, some of that happens in more informal ways, which is kids living in a home with their parents longer, kids moving in with their adults, kids moving in with grandparents and, you know, multi-generational living. All those things are happening as well outside of what, you know, Fred's describing as co-housing might be. Many more unrelated individuals sharing a housing unit. You're seeing some of that in particularly high-cost markets, San Francisco, New York. You know, there's We Live and other kinds of almost dorm-like living situations that are coming up. Still small, but I think all a response to this fact that something's got to give if housing's costing that much as a share of people's incomes.
Chris, your report, can it actually be a tool for predicting where things are headed, or do you not see it that way?
Well, you know, I think we're sometimes accused of being the joint center for gloom and doom because we point this gloomy picture. And the truth is that what we've seen over the span of the last five decades, really, is that housing costs have continued to grow faster than income. Some decades are better than others. Some are worse. This last decade happened to be one of the worst. And so there is fundamentally here, there's one piece of this, which is just one about income inequality and the fact that, you know, incomes, wages in the bottom, the middle half of the income distribution have not been going up very fast, and housing has. And so the gloomy forecast would be, you know, given that we don't see those kind of broad macroeconomic trends changing, there's likely to be continued pressure on housing costs. The optimistic side would be, you know, that I think that this pressure that the affordability is producing or creating is leading to a lot more creative thought about what do we do about it. And I think, you know, the fact, again, going back to your opening, the mayor is saying this is something we have to worry about, will lead cities like Kansas City to think about how do we change our regulatory structure to make it easier to build housing that's more affordable. It's leading manufacturers of housing to think about how do we employ panelized and modular construction to bring down the cost of housing. And it's leading people on the finance side to say, how do we come up with new ways of sharing costs to make housing more affordable, and co-housing and other things as well. So I think we're seeing some creativity and innovation happening to address it, but I think the fundamental macroeconomic conditions are such that the pressures are going to remain on affordability.
I have heard from a few sources lately that people are predicting another recession. Is that something that would factor into that? I mean, thinking about it in terms of what might happen with housing as a result or even as a possible cause, would that look like another foreclosure crisis like we saw in 2009 or something else entirely?
You know, I don't think that we're likely to see another foreclosure crisis like 2009, thank God. You know, and the issue, you know, as we're going into that period, we had a very highly leveraged homeowning population. And so people had taken on enormous amounts of debt relative to housing values, and were also taking out mortgages that had very risky features. And so I think that level of leverage in the system is not nearly what it was. The degree to which mortgages have risky features is not nearly what it was. All those things would suggest there's a lot more ability of the housing system to absorb a downturn. But, you know, a recession meaning that people's incomes would fall would definitely mean that there'd be some hardship. It could have the benefit of reducing the pressure on prices and rent. So,
yeah.
But all things considered, recession wouldn't be a good thing.
Chris Herbert, thank you so much. Chris joined us from the Harvard Joint Centers for Housing Studies. I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll be talking about American Sign Language. The story of that becoming a new major at KU is next, and you can join in by video on KCUR's Facebook page. We will have an interpreter with us in the studio. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and KU just announced that starting in the 2019-2020 academic year, students can get a Bachelor of Arts degree in American Sign Language. Majoring in languages isn't new. You can already study Czech, Farsi, Wolof, but until next year, American Sign Language courses offered through the School of Education require special permission if you're outside the School of Education, and the credits don't transfer automatically. Why did the school change its policy, and what does the change represent to the deaf community? Let's get the story. My first guest is Stacy Storm. She teaches American Sign Language, and she was instrumental in pushing the change through. She's going to respond to my first question only in sign language. So if you hear a little silence, that's what's going on. Hi, Stacy. So now, Stacy, tell me the story. What inspired you to really push to make American Sign Language a major at KU?
So one of the reasons, and first I want to clarify, I don't teach American Sign Language. I teach interpretation.
Oh, okay.
That is a common misconception, is that learning American Sign Language is just like learning interpreting, and it's not. So would you repeat your question again?
Yeah.
So
what made you interested in seeing American Sign Language become a major, mm-hmm. an area like you could get a Bachelor of Arts in American Sign Language at KU?
Yes. So I just came from Johnson County Community College. I was there for 18 years, and we had an interpreting training program there and taught American Sign Language as well. What we we realized was, and across the country people realize, that learning American Sign Language at the same time you learn interpreting is not effective. We would never expect people to come in with no Spanish and learn, take two semesters, and then begin to interpret for people who are Spanish speakers in their lives. So that's one of the main drivers that we wanted to allow Johnson County Community College to provide a foundation in American Sign Language for students and learning about deaf culture, and then transferring on to KU to do advanced American Sign Language and deaf culture, and then begin the work of learning interpreting.
So kind of separating the practical implementation of the skill in a professional setting from the study of the language itself.
Yes, yes.
So would you say that there is a growing demand for people with that level of expertise and understanding of American Sign Language? Or do you think that maybe what you're looking at is a change in understanding of what this language even is?
I do think, and I know you haven't yet introduced Chris, but
speak with another guest. Okay,
yes, I just hope she can clarify if I'm speaking incorrectly. But I do think, in general, changing the perception is a big part of this. That commonly people think American Sign Language is a manual code that you just add hand gestures and you're using English but manually, which is not the case. Typically, people view, I think, deaf people through a disability lens. And we, especially me as an educator and a part of the deaf community growing up, I have an older deaf sister, very much view the deaf community through a cultural linguistic lens. And so that in and of itself is a big need for people to understand.
Yeah. What interests you about American Sign Language as a language?
Well, it's one of my native languages. I grew up spoken English, of course, and also an American Sign Language user. So it's my life. I don't even see it as an interest.
Yeah. It seems to me that although American Sign Language is a language like any other, just period, mm-hmm. it sometimes gets seen by the general public as an accommodation, which is not the same thing, and it's obviously a grave misunderstanding. Can you talk more about that?
Yes. So as I said, I think seeing it as an accommodation demonstrates the perception of seeing deaf people as a disability or as a disabled group, whereas deaf people themselves, a large part of the deaf community, sees themselves as a part of a cultural community. And so me as an ASL user, I definitely see the difference between English and American Sign Language and have that value.
Talk to me a little bit about what interests you looking back on the conversations mm-hmm. you had to get this worked through, this whole mm-hmm. change at KU. Mm-hmm.
I think it will have two main impacts that I see eventually happening. One is from a student perspective, that the students who have come to the program at Johnson County Community College often experienced struggle and a lot of stress to
learn. It's a very renowned program nationwide.
Yes, absolutely. We at JCCC were one of very few two-year programs to be accredited nationally and worked very hard to have great standards and graduates of that program continue to be excellent practitioners. However, the experience of learning both the language and interpreting at the same time is highly stressful. So one of the impacts I think will help their experience to be much more successful, and they will be set up for success, which then will lead to their services being more consistent and the deaf community and hearing community actually being able to rely on more quality interpreting.
Do you remember getting the news that it was going to happen?
Yes. Yes.
Take me to that moment.
Okay. So I started this process with KU probably 2 or 3 years ago, and the day that it became official, announced through KBOR, was, I think I was just in shock mostly. But it's very exciting.
If you want to join the conversation, please comment on our live video stream on Facebook. We are especially interested in whether this means something to our local deaf community to be seen and understood in this way. KU is now offering a major in American Sign Language for a bachelor's degree. The video is on KCUR's Facebook page. My next guest is with us from the Museum of Deaf History, Arts, and Culture. It's the only museum independently operated by the deaf community for the deaf community. It's in Olathe. Chris Daly joins us now with an interpreter. Hi, Chris.
Hello. The museum is also for people that can hear as well.
For everyone, but yes. What does this mean to you to see KU treating American Sign Language as a language?
I'm thrilled. Speaking for the deaf community, we are very thrilled. It shows more recognition. So people can look at ASL itself as something that actually is a true language that can be studied, that can be respected. And in the same way deaf people see English programs, we, you know, people that want to become an English teacher, they get a bachelor's in English. Now people realize that they can get actually a degree in ASL, and it will help the program and help people realize hiring someone coming in that just knows sign language, now they know that they actually have a degree. And it will definitely increase standards for the interpreters, and that's a benefit for the deaf community. It will also have a huge impact on deaf educators and deaf and hard of hearing youth in the state. They will now recognize ASL as an actual language, and then that can be more included in their education. And it will emphasize how the students need that language in their ASL education. They need to learn English, they need to learn math and history and all of that just the same. It's very exciting to see the advanced recognition of ASL, the language itself. And it's going to have great impacts in many, many different aspects of the deaf daily lives.
When you talk about deaf culture, that's part of the name of your museum. Where does American Sign Language fit into that, to the culture around deafness?
If you think about language, language is impacted by culture and the people. Language is organic. It evolves through the years, through the history of time, by the people. So the deaf community as a culture is impacted by ASL, both. They go hand in hand, actually. Deaf culture is obviously a group of people that sign, that use a visual language. And we have deaf culture all around the world, not just ASL. We have, each country has their own sign language. They have their own deaf culture, too. Obviously, it's based on visual values, visual foundation, and people who can hear follow by hearing the sounds of the language, and that's often structured, the audio part of their language is structured, and with deaf culture, it is structured around the visual aspect of it. So, for example, the lighting is important for, they do visual storytelling, colors are valuable, we use facial expressions, how we express our thoughts.
You know, I understand that as you learn sign language, as a deaf person learns sign language, you actually start to dream more vividly?
Language becomes more clear. Definitely the thinking becomes more clear. Deaf people are often taught ASL. They start using ASL first. They think about teaching English. Oftentimes it's not very successful. For example, when teachers are using spoken English, the students are relying on hearing how the language is used. The language skills are developed more fully in other areas of the life, are not developed more fully in other areas of the life, and how we communicate. So yeah, go ahead.
This seems like a significant part of just that access to language is just such a big part of humanity, being human.
Yes, yes. United Nations has already identified, recognized that all humans have a right to language. If we don't have access to a language, it impacts everything in our lives, how we access information, how we don't have due process without language. It impacts everything. You really can't even hold a job. So every human has the right to language, and deaf people also have the right to sign language. And then when we have that access, it opens the door to everything, really.
You know, but like, then the more people know your language, the more understood you are on that deeply human level, the more connected and integrated you are, period. That's what seems significant to me about this change, really culturally, that you would be able to major in sign language the way I could go and major in Spanish and understand Spanish-speaking cultures in a different way.
Yes, you're right, yes.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're talking about American Sign Language on the radio and on video. We're streaming live on Facebook. We have an interpreter in the studio, and you can comment to join the discussion. We'll pick right back up with this in just a minute. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about the importance of American Sign Language as a language, period, one that's part of a culture, as all languages are, in this case, deaf culture. My guests are Stacy Storm, an interpreter who also teaches interpretation and got sign language turned into a major at KU, and Chris Daly, president of the Museum of Deaf History, Arts, and Culture in Olathe. Chris is deaf herself. She joins us with an interpreter who you can see on Facebook Live. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
And Chris, let's dig into what deaf culture is a little bit through that arts piece of it. Talk to me about deafness in the arts and the role of American Sign Language in that.
I think that art is always a beautiful medium of how to express something in a way that words can't. And it's really for every culture, especially the oppressed. From oppressed groups, it's really expressive. For deaf people, it's okay to express our experiences in our daily lives. Especially adults as they experience their youth who didn't have ASL. They seem to think they're alone in their experience, and then they get to express it through art. And it's a beautiful way of showing other future parents with deaf children what the experience was like and gives them something to think about as they raise their deaf children. 97% of deaf people are born to hearing parents. And most of the parents have never even met deaf people at that point. They're born, they have a baby that's the first deaf person they ever meet. So for me, it's a good way to impact the parents and people who work in the school system. It gives them a better understanding and a better understanding of the experience of the deaf community, and it opens their mind to understanding and respect. And it's a better way to express ourselves using ASL. I'm really excited about this program, just raising the standards and encouraging that understanding.
Yeah, it does. You know, what I was just thinking as you were talking is that part of the reason parents maybe haven't met another deaf person until having their own child born deaf is that if not very many people know American Sign Language, then the community really remains unto itself.
Yes.
How do you see that changing, perhaps, as people are able to study American Sign Language more and more at the collegiate level?
I think the beautiful impact of the ASL recognition is twofold. For deaf people, it increases their sense of well-being and feeling whole. Before the 1960s, ASL was considered an inferior way of communication. They didn't work good with language at that time. Sign language was banned in schools. In the 80s, kids that were going to school had no sign language access. It was a huge struggle. It was a struggle for the students and also the teachers before the 80s, maybe in 50% of the schools working. They were working as superintendents. They had different jobs, various jobs, and when the sign language was banned, they were fired. So that was an impact on our sense of well-being, of who we are, and we were looked down upon. After the 1960s, they started recognizing it as an actual language, and it started becoming more and more popular, and that gave the deaf community an actual sense of having a right to be in the community and be on this earth. For people that can hear, it's a huge impact because they realize that they can actually learn the language too, and it's equal to other languages, becoming very popular. Suppose a student wants to take ASL for a foreign language credit. Sign language is now, I think, the third or fourth most popular foreign language, and that meets their credit needs. So it's a big impact to have more and more people, more hearing people taking sign language. And then that just makes it easier for the deaf and hearing community to associate together. I moved to Olathe a few years ago, and the school for the deaf there has so many people, there's so many stores, many store owners and other businesses that naturally start learning sign language. So I can come in and actually sign hello and let them know I'm deaf, and they immediately get a piece of paper and write back and forth with me. So there's no fear. I feel like I'm equal to them now. It feels like the community, we're peers in the community now, and it's bringing it to a whole new level.
So many hearing children are now learning at least the sign language alphabet as part of their very early education. Do you see that making a difference just in the larger culture?
Yes, I think that's great. I think that's great that the parents are using ASL to communicate. Research has shown already that when babies can develop language before they actually can use their vocal cords and speak, they can use sign language. And the irony of it is, with deaf babies, many doctors or medical professionals will tell the parents, don't sign to the baby. You need to focus on a background, a basis of English first. So they're encouraged not to sign to their babies. And I think that's really ironic. And I'm really hoping that the irony will fade.
Yeah, like hearing children are saying all done in sign language. Meanwhile, that's surprising that it isn't encouraged in at least the same way. You know, I don't mean to be hung up on the arts piece of this, but because sign language is a language you perform with your body, like you perform any language with your body, but a spoken language would be performed more like singing, whereas sign language is performed more like dancing. And I'm curious about the deaf community in the arts, in dance, and I hear that there's also a growing movement of sign language rap.
They call it slam poetry. It's actually becoming very popular. It's a very good way to express thoughts and using ASL at the same time, so they call that slam poetry. It's really cool. Storytelling is really big in the deaf community. Slam is also part of storytelling. But we use storytelling in so many different ways. And some of it is how we use the ABCs, sometimes it's how we use hand shapes, and that's how we tell our stories. It's poetry itself. It's putting your thoughts out into a picture with no English spoken words.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the different, maybe, styles of sign language? Like, if I were to talk about people's voices, I might talk about someone has a high voice or a low voice or... just the different styles that people express through their use of American Sign Language.
Yes, I can. to compare it, someone would sign really big in a really big sign space, and someone would sign in a really small sign space, so that would depend on their personality. Or same as hearing someone's voice, you can tell by their tone if they're angry or sad. And with sign language, you see that through their facial expressions. And you can match you can see the intensity of the signs by their signs and their facial expressions.
That just brings us back to this idea of American Sign Language as a rich, nuanced, layered language like any other, full of its own history and its own expressiveness. And Stacey Storm, I'd like you to jump back in here and talk to me about that from the academic perspective. What would you like to see included in a major in American Sign Language?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we really worked on when we started to develop this new curriculum and ideas for the bachelor's degree.
And this is again at KU.
At KU Edwards, yes. we involved some community folks to be a part of this conversation. And one of the things we really worked hard to do, and Chris talked about this a little, is bringing culture and language together. So it's not only courses in American Sign Language, but also there's, for example, one of the courses this fall is going to be the intersectionality in the deaf communities. So that will bring a social justice lens and really allow students to look at the deaf community as a whole and the intersections of identity that exist within the deaf community. It's not deaf people are just deaf people, right? But you have all kinds of identities within that community. We also will be offering classes in discourse analysis, so looking at the discourse of American Sign Language. And for students who are second language learners of this, the modality switch is also a big change for them. They're mostly used to learning information and receiving it auditorily, and it's a big shift to take in information visually. Things that they may have overlooked, nuances and subtleties of the language, have a significant impact.
You know, it's funny you should say that. Even right now during this interview, mm-hmm. my typical approach to multitasking has had to shift because I need my eyes differently.
Yes, yes. And that's a big, so one of the things that I think has made JCC see one of the a very well-known program is all of our instructors who teach American Sign Language are indeed deaf, and they do not use spoken English as they instruct American Sign Language. And so that
immersion,
yes, so that's a way to have language and cultural immersion and just help hearing students to start to not rely on their ears but to start relying on their eyes.
Chris, what would you want to see included in a bachelor's degree curriculum for American Sign Language? If you could just like have a fantasy course that you would either take yourself or just having people out there learning about.
I think a big piece that's missing when I work with interpreters is the lack of understanding of deaf culture. There are a lot of nuances that only come from actually being immersed in the community. An interpreter themselves may be married a deaf person or really have a job that has them immersed in the deaf culture, then they have a better understanding of how to work with deaf people. So I think that is a big important part of the program, that the students have more time to socialize with the deaf community. People think they go and learn from a book or video and they're ready, but there's still a lot of it missing, and that definitely impacts the quality of the interpretation. You see, for now, you probably noticed how I'm struggling because I'm trying to see your eyes looking through all the technical equipment in the room. This is definitely a situation set up for hearing people that are relying on hearing, and deaf people rely on communication with eye contact, and that's a very small part that people don't think about. That's a very important part is the eye contact. So you notice I keep looking to see your facial expressions to make sure you're understanding me. So that's part of communication. That's just a little part of it.
Yeah, and I would think even, everything down, including even etiquette, mm-hmm. would be different.
Absolutely.
And it's just a whole, a lot to learn, and that's why there's going to be a major at KU. It's a big change, and it's something that a lot of people are really excited about. Stacey Storm, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Chris Daly, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us come.
This conversation has been streaming live on Facebook. Thanks to KCUR's Cody Newell for dropping everything to make that happen. You can grab the video conversation anytime on Facebook, and you can get the audio at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. kcur.org/centralstandard, where we archive all our past shows. Tomorrow is a food show. We're hungry for salad. Yes, that is possible. Call in with your favorite. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Ann Knigendorf, and intern Riley Kester. I'm Gina Kaufman. Thanks for tuning in. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.